Hello and welcome to AIPT Comics Podcast, the number one comic book podcast at AIPTcomics.com. We are here.
Hey.
Yeah, there he is.
Hey.
Oh, there he is again.
I'm the official substitute teacher of AIPT Comics, and we're going to watch a video today, class.
Oh, boy. Put it in. Is it a VHS?
You know it.
Nathan's here subbing in for Forrest this week.
That's correct.
And we have some exciting stuff for you, Nathan and I. We're going to be talking with Joshua Williamson about his new series, Batman Superman, his current series, Flash, and how cool he is as a DC Comics writer.
Yes. We're going to ask him exactly how cool he is.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how cool are you, Joshua? This is the 26th episode, which, if you do your math, carry the 1, divided by 3, this is the middle of the year, right? We're halfway through the year.
We're in the middle of it.
Of this weekly podcast.
Yeah.
So I'm so glad to be here and still doing it on this show. We keep you up to date on what's going on with comic books. And at the top of our show, we always talk about the news. Then we go into maybe a little reviewing, and then we talk about next week. And then later in this show, we will be talking with Joshua Williamson. So to start, the news.
Yes.
Everyone loves it.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the biggest news of the week.
Oh, yeah.
DC Comics. Oh, my God. Upsetting folks, making people cry, maybe. I don't know. They are replacing all of their imprints. Yes, all of them. Well, not all of them. They're getting rid of DC Vertigo, DC Inc., DC Zoom.
Yep.
Say it ain't so. They're doing this because they want to do like an age labeling system so that I suppose it's easier for the customers to know which imprint their middle schoolers can read, their children can read, and then adults, right?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. The idea is that the central age label, they said, is going to be 13 and up. So that's mainly like the superhero titles. And then Black Label is going to continue with like a 17 plus rating on it. So they are officially saying we're the R-rated action, R-rated action movies of the DCU.
Right.
It's interesting. I wonder, like, with the the Sandman universe is going to continue, but I don't know it. I haven't seen anything on like what kind of age range they're planning on gearing that toward, because it seems to fall somewhat in the middle.
Oh, there is sometimes nudity though.
Oh yeah, especially in the,
like,
dreaming.
In the dreaming. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Do you think kids are going to be excited to read DC Kids? Do kids like being called kids?
That's the thing. When I was younger, I never really gravitated toward, and this might just be like a, you know, little boy in the 90s kind of thing. Like, I want stuff that's cool and with explosions.
Right.
But I never like drifted towards stuff that was specifically aimed at kids. I mean, again, your mileage may vary, but the closest I got was Lil Archie. But otherwise, I was reading in 1993, 94, I was reading Maximum Carnage. So, which, you know, is not necessarily a failure on my parents' part. It is interesting that now as an adult, I get more into the kid oriented comics, because occasionally I just feel like I need a breather from all the death and destruction.
Yeah, and those stories can still be highly entertaining at
Absolutely.
Whatever age you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, the Comics Code Authority, that's gone, right? It's been gone
Correct.
For a while.
Yeah.
I don't see anyone like screaming we need, you know, some sort of labeling like this so that parents or kids or whoever knows at what level they can be reading an imprint.
Right. And sometimes it feels like it's more aimed at, like, the age brackets can be more aimed at intent of the book more so than content.
Yeah.
Because I remember picking up when Marvel Knights would run like their, you know, 16 plus or whatever on the covers. And, you know, it's a ghostwriter story is a ghostwriter story. Like, it's normally not something that's going to traumatize a kid.
Right.
So it's still...
Although it was originally made to be a monster comic, I think.
That's true.
That's the approach anyway. But even then, they weren't like necessarily making something as graphic as you can get today.
Right, exactly. So it'll be interesting. I mean, it's sad to lose. There's something that feels comforting about, you know, seeing that Vertigo banner on a book.
Yeah.
Something that made me really happy. I never thought that I'd be able to subscribe to a Vertigo book again. And that's almost everything on my pull list now.
Right.
So it is a bummer, but I'm hoping it doesn't mean bad news for, you know, the titles going forward.
Right. And Jim Lee, I think, tweeted yesterday or the day before that nothing's being canceled. We're just sort of rejiggering the imprint labels.
Sure.
Personally, I don't know why they're getting rid of Vertigo and replacing it with Black Label. Since Black Label is so new, it's hardly known. Vertigo has history, especially if you're in your 30s and you grew up reading Vertigo books when you shouldn't have been when you were 11.
Right. Well, and Black Label seems to be trying to do what Vertigo was doing in the 90s.
Yes. Well, the superheroes.
Exactly.
I guess. That's the only difference, right?
Yeah, but the thing is with Vertigo now, I don't want to say it's sanitized, but it definitely does. There is like less of a dangerous edge to it than there was, you know, when they were, you know, earlier. And that I feel like maybe DC felt like that was where Black Label came in.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of Black Label's, I don't want to say a lot of Black Label's output, but especially with Batman Damned, it does have kind of a try hard mentality to it more so than it does. There's kind of a lack of sophistication there, which I still get from the Vertigo books.
Yeah, I could see that. Especially when you're using, you know, serial characters like Batman. It's not as adventurous or inventive as a Vertigo book or an Image Comics book or a Vault Comics book. I mean, the argument is interesting that does DC Vertigo need to exist if there are other publishers putting out horror and other adult-themed stories that are original and not creator-owned.
I do think that there is a place for them to say that this is not necessarily what we are known for. If you're looking for something a little more cerebral or horror-tinged, you know, this is the banner to look for. I do think that there is something to that, but they're muddying the waters a bit because they're also putting out reprints of stuff like Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns under Black Label, yeah? It's almost retroactively lending legitimacy to this new venture, which is, it's just kind of an odd move.
It is, yeah. It's like a video game. This is how I equate it. When Nintendo comes out with a new system, if they do not have 10 to like 15 new games, they have like one or two,
right?
No one's going to be talking about it. And that's what Black Label has felt to me.
Sure.
Like, okay, one title. Is Black Label just like something you're slapping on this one book and then you'll be done with it? Or
right.
I mean, they didn't give like a wide range of stories to give us a taste of what it meant.
Right. You know? So these reprints are, if we're following this analogy, is the triple game Duck Hunt Mario Brothers world class track meet like combo pack.
Right. I really want to know what Neil Gaiman thinks about all this.
I know, he's been pretty quiet about it, I think.
Yeah, he's too busy doing that new show on Amazon, Good Omens.
As well he should be, it's fantastic.
It is really good. In our next bit of news, DC announces a new line of young adult and middle school age graphic novels.
I'm super into this. But again, it is very strange. Like, we just talked about how they're restructuring and going for more age-appropriate, like age-labeled books. And then they're like, but also, here's 40 new kids books we're putting out.
That's a lot.
They've got a pretty like solid plan, and they've got all these titles with characters that I love. The idea of, I mean, Zatanna is like tailor-made for a YA series, so the idea that they're coming right out of the gate with some Zatanna books is fun. Gotham
did
High.
Did you read Super Sons, the first one?
It was really fun.
It's interesting. I like how it like just kind of changes the characters.
Yeah. But it's very accessible without you having to like know years of which is one of the other things I really am looking forward to with this. Like, they're doing a Batman Tales one that is essentially the Lil Gotham creative team like getting back together.
Right. Which is cool, yeah.
Can I point out there's a few that have like tentative titles and dates, but that I can't wait to see what they are.
Sure.
There's one that's called The Mystery of the Meanest Teacher, a Johnny Constantine graphic novel, which means we're getting Lil Hellblazer and makes me so happy. But the one that I'm really hype on, it's called Superman Smashes the Klan, which, first of all, is an amazing rhyming title. But
is it Klan with a K?
With a K, my good sir. Whoa. So if we're getting a middle school book with Superman beating the shit out of the KKK, that I think we can stop. Like, comics have reached their final evolution. Like, we can't we can't top this.
If you go to AIPTcomics.com and go to our article on this, you can see the full list.
Yes, yeah.
Of titles.
There's some really exciting stuff. I mean, they're bringing in a lot of, like, the big names, but there's also, you know, they're doing a, there's a Amethyst book, there's a Swamp Thing book, which I'm very excited about. It looks it's like they've range. Really planned this out. I'm very excited.
I mean, especially compared to DC Black Label, they're just, like, inundating us with books. You could fill a library with all these books that are coming
out. You literally could. I you know, I always have friends with kids who ask me what comics to I'd recommend to them.
Yes.
And I'm always a little iffy on it, because you know, just because I love Scooby-Doo doesn't, or you know, Jim and the Holograms doesn't necessarily mean that there's that built-in, you know, nostalgia for it. And this would be like a really great thing to point out to, like, looks like they're launching them in spring of next year.
To DC's credit, then, it does make sense if you're trying to introduce comics to a new reader to just hand them this list.
And this shows like a real follow through on their part, so that's exciting.
It is. Now, is Zoom and Ink underneath DC Kids now, or what?
That's unclear to me as well.
Because technically, the middle school aged kids are not kids, right? I guess I don't know. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I've always thought that was YA, but I guess YA is more aimed at teens. Listeners, if you can go to your nearest Barnes & Noble and let me know if YA and teen are two different sections, I don't know.
So next in the news, Marvel solicitations came out.
Yes.
Yay, for September.
Always exciting.
And there's some big things. Now, if you follow comic book news like we do, and it trickles out throughout the month, you will know that actually Marvel kind of spoils all the solicitations over the course of the month.
Yep.
So, for instance, like the Alpha Flight True North series that's coming out, that was already, they already revealed that like a day or two before the full solicitations came out. Or like how the Acts of Evil annuals are concluding in September. Already kind of leaked out. Including leaks is the J.J. Abrams comic that's coming out.
Maybe the biggest Marvel-related news this week.
That it was. What's funny is that leaked, what, four, five, eight hours before the full solicitations came out?
Yeah. Well, and it was like the end result of like three or four days of a countdown that was driving people insane.
Right. Everyone thought when they first saw the four, they thought that C.B. Sobolski, the editor-in-chief at Marvel Comics, was teasing a Sam Raimi produced or screenplay written by him that would be turned into a comic or something.
Which, to be fair, it looks like the teaser posters that they used for those movies.
It does. Yeah.
And there's a precedent for it with, you know, Wonder Woman 77 and stuff like that, but I would have read the hell out of that book, though.
You know, I wonder, like, he must have saw everyone, like, losing their minds and getting excited for that. And he's probably calling Sam Raimi's, like, agent right now.
Sam Raimi's like, can Darkman be in it also?
Yes, team up, crossover.
I'm into it.
So this book is written by J.J. Abrams and his son, Henry Abrams. Mm-hmm. And it's drawn by Sarah Pacelli with covers by Olivier Coipel. And it's a miniseries. They're just branding it Spider-Man. And they're going to be introducing a new villain named Cadaverous, who I think collects dead bodies. Like, oh, is this going to be like a Weekend at Bernie's thing?
I hope so.
Oh, Cadaverous is actually Bernie. Big twist.
That's how they get Gwen Stacy back.
No, but are you excited for this?
Yeah, it's exciting. I will say, I was one of the folks that was a little underwhelmed at the initial announcement, just because there was so much hype built up for it, and then it was literally nothing that anyone could have guessed, you know. it'd be like if DC had really built up to announcing when Richard Donner was gonna co-write Superman. But the idea that this is a it's out of continuity, has that been announced?
I don't
yet?
Know if
maybe
they've
it's not
said that yet. I'm not sure.
Either way, it's exciting. I think they both have really J.J. Abrams especially has a really cool visual sense of style. So I think, you know, it'll at least have some, you know, I know it'll have some interesting ideas, and his whole thing is paying tribute to stuff that we love and building on that in new ways.
Right.
I mean, you just have to look at his Star Wars flick and his Star Trek movies.
Lost.
And Lost. And it's so I'm cautiously optimistic. I'm always a little iffy when someone outside of the realm of comics, you know, gets a big marquee title like that. I mean, it's also ballsy as hell that it's just called Spider-Man.
It is, yeah. What complicates it is the fact that he's working with his son. Uh-huh. Who's only 20, has no writing credits.
Yes.
Completely unknown. So yeah. It feels, I think I've seen some people shouting on the internets about nepotism, how this isn't fair, et cetera, yeah. et cetera. Now, in the interview
Jerry
that
Conway
JJ
was pretty mean about it too, actually.
Oh, yes.
He said it was something like, it's not, they're not writing a book in the, he said something along the lines of like, they're not writing a book in the same way that Stan Lee or Nick Spencer writes a Spider-Man comic.
Right.
Because that's become the big headline is J.J. Abrams is writing a Spider-Man comic. Oh, this is what he said. Jerry Conway says, no, he's not. He's going to talk over an idea with his son, and his son will do the actual writing. it can't help
a
but
little
feel...
presumptuous.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And now Gail Simone came out, too, uh-huh. and sort of defended it, which was interesting.
I always count on Gail Simone to try to keep people honest.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And I mean, she had some good points.
Yeah, for sure.
Essentially, I mean, she compared it to Joss Whedon doing a comic series.
Right.
She said this isn't taking a job away from anyone since it's not a main series.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is a good point. And I mean, it's definitely cross-pollinating for J.J. Abrams fans to maybe read a comic that they wouldn't have.
Oh, for sure. I think I mentioned this before we started recording, but like Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men got me back into reading X-Men books for the first time since I was a kid. It can go one of two ways. It can be Astonishing X-Men or it can be Daredevil Bullseye, you know? Like
right,
it'll
right.
it'll either take off and surprise everyone or it'll fizzle out like you said. But I'm cautiously optimistic.
It's also interesting to me that it's coming out in a month when Absolute Carnage is like taking over every single Spider-Man book.
Oh, sure.
And you know, maybe that's how they planned it though, because I'm sure all these Absolute Carnage books are going to be so symbiote heavy that mm-hmm. a casual person who maybe is coming off of the new Spider-Man movie
right.
isn't going to necessarily be able to pick up a Spider-Man book and be like, wait, what the hell? What are all these? Now, who's Scream, right?
Right.
Whereas with this J.J. Abrams book, maybe they could be like, oh, Spider-Man. Yeah, this is like the Spider-Man in the movie, although it probably isn't because he's older.
And what's interesting to me is it does get into that little hyperbole. Like J.J. Abrams has said, we'll see Peter Parker in a way we've never seen him before.
Right.
And to me, I have to take that with a grain of salt. Not because I think I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, a fake fan or whatever. Mm. But like, you have to wonder how often J.J. Abrams gets a chance to read a comic book. You know?
Yeah.
He's a very busy guy.
How would he know?
Right, exactly.
He's like, I have this idea.
Yeah.
Mephisto, this demon comes out of nowhere and makes Peter forget that he was ever married to Mary Jane. What do you think? Joe Quesada literally wakes up from a nap and is like, what? Something's happening.
He's like sweating. But on the other hand, his Henry Abrams is perfectly within the age of someone to be, you know, reading comics on the reg.
Sure.
So
that's true.
Maybe they'll be able to balance each other out in an interesting way.
A couple other highlights from the solicitations. King Thor is coming out. Uh-huh. Jason Aaron and Asad Ribic are joining forces once again, like they did when they first started this epic Thor run, which is going to be pretty cool. And
yeah.
apparently Loki gets this blade of the god Butcher had.
Yes.
And he's got it in his hand. So it's the ultimate Thor versus Loki story, possibly. Some other ones are coming out. Black Panther, Agents of Wakanda is kicking off.
That looks super fun.
Chris Claremont and Bill Sienkiewicz
yes.
is doing the New Mutants War Children number one, a one-shot that is telling stories never told from that era when they were writing.
Yeah, that's really exciting, too.
It is. And Tom Taylor's doing a really cool Mary Jane solo issue, which should be interesting.
Ooh, I didn't
on the
know
cover.
About that.
She's wearing the Spider-Man costume.
Fantastic. You know, you can't help but wonder if that New Mutants book would be like even more exciting if there was a movie coming out like
I know right
that was attached to it yeah, there's a lot of really interesting stuff coming up. I love Jason Aaron's whole run on Thor and the
yes, me too.
Returning to the God Butcher and you know old mm-hmm. King Thor is very exciting.
Very exciting. And if you're a Star Wars fan, there's a lot going on too. They're doing Age of Resistance. Tom Taylor's writing them all. These one-shots focused on characters like Kylo Ren.
Yeah, and he promises his shirt will stay on. Tom Taylor promises.
That dude is so thick. Also, Snoke. They're doing a Snoke comic, guys.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll learn anything? Now, I have to tell you, cautiously enter these comics because I've reviewed and read a lot of these one-shots, and they add almost nothing to the actual mythos.
Well, because they're nervous. They can't. Yeah. This is the problem with any kind of adaptation. I think I talked about this a little bit in one of my when I reviewed the last Dr. Horrible comic. If you're if you're a writer who's worried about stepping on the toes of the creators on the off chance that something new is going to happen with these characters, it's very difficult to write around. And some writers are better at that than others, of finding ways to kind of explore the universe without necessarily leaving a heavy stamp on it. That being said, I hope the Snoke issue is literally from the point of view of the janitor that has to like clean up after.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
But like that TIE Fighter issue was really great. The one that came out recently. Was it Jody Houser that did TIE Fighter? Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic.
Yeah, I've been reviewing that myself. It's been really good.
Yeah.
It's fun to see the villain side, especially if they not only humanize them, but make them the hero in their own story.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Do you think in the Snoke story, there'll be like this guy, he's like, hey, Snoke, this is a really cool like guard you can put on your lightsaber so no one can just like turn it on. And he's like, get out of my sight. And he cuts him in half.
Yeah. No one will ever get that close. When you watched Force Awakens for the first time, did you for a half second think that Snoke was gigantic and it wasn't a hologram?
Yes. There was no... You know what it needed to happen in that shot where you see his like hologram?
It wasn't very flickery.
No, he needed to hold up a banana. You know, for scale.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I'm an idiot. And the first time I saw Force Awakens, I was like, damn, they got a giant in charge.
Okay, that's the news, folks. In our next segment, we talk about the top books of last week, our favorite comics that came out last week. And to start this segment, we always talk about comicbookroundup.com, the Rotten Tomatoes of comic book reviews.
Yeah.
The number one critic pick was Savage Sword of Conan, number 6, by Meredith Finch, with art by Luke Ross, with a 9.5, folks, a 9.5, and the highest rated fan-reviewed comic. Lucifer, number 9, by Dan Waters and Kelly Jones, with a 9.8. That's almost perfect.
That really surprised me. I mean, I'm loving the Lucifer book, though. Especially, I'm a sucker for Kelly Jones art, especially when he's doing gothic horror, and he's such a great choice for this series.
He gets the body horror.
Oh yeah, the mini series he did with Lynn Wine, the Swamp Thing mini a few years ago, was just genuinely terrifying. The specter hasn't been that scary in a long time.
I think I reviewed almost every issue of that too.
Oh.
So what is your number one pick?
My number one pick is James Bond 007, number 8, written by Greg Pak, art by Eric Gapster. This book has been just a blast from the get-go, and the thing that I'm really loving about it, and that I keep kind of coming back to in my reviews to the point where I feel like maybe I'm repeating myself a little bit, is I love how much Greg Pak understands the trappings and the tropes of James Bond and uses those fan expectations to tell exciting story. It's not curveballs for the sake of curveballs, but it is genuinely surprising. Like, he's taken Oddjob, the nearly silent henchman from Goldfinger, and made him into this capable badass secret agent. Every time there's a new Bond movie that comes out, you always see, you know, the marketing is like, this time Bond has met his match, but this is the first time it's really felt real, in that Bond has found someone who is exactly as capable and occasionally as ruthless as he is.
Yeah.
And more so than that, Pak has really developed the supporting cast for the series more so than I think anyone has. He's taken what Jody Houser and Warren Ellis did with Eve Moneypenny and really made her like Bond's woman in the chair. Like, she's helping facilitate his missions, and she's a lot more hands-on. At one point in the new issue, she grabs a machine gun and heads to a helicopter to go bail Bond out, and M has to talk her down, and it doesn't come off like an employee or like an employer like berating, you know, one of his subordinates, there's a level of like respect between the characters that I think is so important and that we've never really seen with a lot of the trappings of James Bond. It's so much fun. Lots of great detective and spycraft stuff. And I've already gone on record on this podcast as being a huge Bond fanatic. So The fact that I get two great books a month in 007 and James Bond Origin, I'm completely spoiled.
Dynamite has really done a great job, I feel. I mean, I really liked Warren Ellis's run.
I did too.
At the time. I think, who was the artist? Masters, I think his name was?
Yeah, I think so.
You know what? I have not dabbled in the Greg Pak run, and I love Greg Pak, so I don't know why I'm not, but I need to, based on your reviews especially.
And he's doing the same. He's doing a very similar thing that he did with Agents of Atlas, where he's just telling really fun spy stories. There's just the action scenes when they happen are bonkers, but it's not necessarily the focus on the book. There's a lot more intrigue and less like blockbuster fights, which I'm really digging. It feels like the right synthesis between the Fleming novels, which were a lot more spy based, and the, you know, the wackier movies,
right, with the gadgets and whatnot.
Yeah, for sure.
Speaking of gadgets,
yeah.
My number one pick is Rick and Morty number 51.
Fantastic.
Written by Kyle Starks, with art by Mark Ellerby, and the backup written by Magdalene Visaggio, with art by Ian McGinty. McGinty? McGinty?
McGinty.
And there you go. I've been reviewing this off and on for the whole 50-issue run. I reviewed the last issue, which was obviously their big milestone 50th issue, which was good. Mm-hmm. This issue, I gave a 10 out of 10. It was so good. And
yeah, you said you thought it was like their best one yet, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think I've given this series a 10 maybe two or three times. It does not happen often. And this issue just knocked me out. Like, Kyle Stark's main story with LRB is just phenomenal. It could be an episode of the show. It basically, Morty finally gets a friend, and the kid is like way too nice to the parents. Like, something's up. He's like either a super nerd or probably an alien. And Rick gets jealous that Morty now has a friend,
right,
who can go on adventures with, or whatever. And there's a big twist, and there's some clever sci-fi ideas in play, which is one of the big reasons why this series works so well. It's not just trying to be funny. It's trying to be good sci-fi storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously there's a humorous tilt to everything, but at the same time, it is leaning into that sci-fi-ness so well that you can respect it for just that alone.
That's when the show works the best too, I think.
And then the backup by Visaggio and McGinty is a good Jerry story.
is there such a thing?
Basically, we find out, like, he probably dies a lot, but he's so boring that death is just like, get the hell out of here. I cannot deal with you.
Oh, my God.
Like, I'm talking like Bill and Ted death, right? Like the sickle and the cloak.
That's great.
Anyway, I highly recommend that issue. It's a phenomenon. So that is our top books of last week. In our next segment, top books for next week,
yeah,
we're going to talk about the book that we're looking forward to the most. Can I go first?
Oh, absolutely. I'm really excited about this one.
Wolverine Exit Wounds number one. This one's written by a bunch of folks you might have heard of. Sam Keith, Larry Hama, Chris Claremont, with art by Sam Keith, Scott Eaton, Salvador LaRocca. I'm super pumped for this, and I'm going to be 100% clear. It's mostly because of Sam Keith.
Sure.
There was a Marvel Comics Presents that he did, one of those flip comics where you flip it over and you just get a different story.
Love, yeah.
He did a Wolverine story where he's just hairy, his freaking costume shredded, he looks awesome. He's like in a bog fighting alligators. It was so cool, and I can't wait to see him take on the character again. And this is obviously a story he's writing and drawing himself. So I don't know exactly if it's like this one issue has the full story, or if all three, because it is three stories by these three creators, and if it will continue. Do you know?
I don't know, actually. I mean, the number one makes me think that it's going to be like a continuing anthology, but I'm not sure.
Right. It could be like Marvel Comics Presents in the other series they're doing right now, where
right,
some of the stories end and some don't.
Right.
We'll see.
That's so exciting, though. I love the whole creative team on that. It just makes me, I mean, the second I see Larry Hama's name on something, I get very happy. So
and this is totally like part of their 80th anniversary. Right. They're trying to like honor these great creators who've created, you know, memories for us over right. the years, and now they get to do it again.
That's awesome.
What's your top book for next week?
I'm really looking forward to IDW's Dick Tracy Forever number 3.
I love the title.
Me too. And the title really works because the concept of this, it's written and drawn by Michael Avon Oeming. And the colors are by Take Soma, and I feel like that adds so much to the book. Like it literally wouldn't work without the beautiful bright colors. But the Dick Tracy Forever has been taking Dick Tracy and depositing him in different time periods. But like each one's a standalone story. So the first is set in the 30s. And so he's going up against very like old school gangster villains. Second one's set in the 60s, and it's very colorful. There's gadgets. The villains are like something right out of Batman 66. And then this issue takes place in modern day.
Ooh.
And I'm really, really excited to see how that kind of optimism and can-do attitude of Dick Tracy translates to now. And I haven't read it yet. I have the review copy sitting in my email, and I literally was like, if I read it, I'm gonna be a liar during this segment. So that is probably what I will do as soon as we're done. I'm very much looking forward to it.
Nice. You think he'll reflect on the 90s culture?
I hope so. I mean, I feel like there is a little bit of a missed opportunity by not doing because the 90s was such a heavy, like everything was merchandise. Like it can't be overstated how much merchandise there was for the Dick Tracy movie. That
yes, I remember it. Oh my God, he's gonna see someone with an Apple Watch and be like, "I have one too."
Well, that's the fun thing is in the first issue he mentions like, "Wouldn't it be great if technology allowed me to just talk to someone with like my watch or whatever?" And then in the 60s issue he's got that. He's got like the, you know, the car, the yellow trench coat, the whole deal. And then the next issue, the final issue, number 4, is going to take place in the future. So I'm very interested to see how they do that.
And with Oeming's art, it's going to be sick.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the Dick Tracy comic strip definitely got into like some, by Chester Gold, definitely got into some weird sci-fi stuff. So I'm sure they'll play with that too. It's a really great take on the kind of hero with 1,000 faces or whatever. Like he's just always working.
Very cool. In our next segment, Judging by the Cover Junior, we talk about our favorite cover art from books coming out on June 26, 2019.
Woo!
What's your pick?
It is Dick Tracy Forever number 3. It is and there's a very specific reason why it's such a cool, it's a very simple cover, but it's got Tracy in a cool pose. He's leaning against the hood of his car, looking all business. But the longer you look at it, the more things kind of stick out to you. There's some really cool storytelling in it that's very subtle. There's a fast food joint in the background. Which is very different from the kind of old-timey all-night diners that you'd normally associate with Dick Tracy. There's a vape shop over his shoulder, which like squarely sets the story in modern day. But the most important thing is that his hat, the bright yellow iconic hat, is blowing away in the wind. It's behind him and he doesn't look back at it. And it's like the most, to me, it's the most elegant, like subtle way to show that this is the Dick Tracy of the modern age and that he's like always moving forward. Like he's leaving behind all the like the colorful, retro stuff.
That's cool.
I really, really love this cover. And again, it's Oeming like knocking it out of the park.
I love the Bende dots on the car.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of that in the interior artwork, too, that it's just super fun.
So, like, I'm a sucker for Bende dots, which is probably why my pick is my pick. It's the Flash number 73. It's the variant cover by Doc Shaner.
Yeah.
It's got Flash running down a skyscraper.
Yeah.
And behind him is the moon. But at first glance, you can't tell. It just looks like he's running down a tunnel because the skyscrapers are kind of engulfing the moon and sky.
Yeah.
Sort of bordering it. And once you realize that, you're like, wait, what? Oh, cool. And then he's got these electricity coming off him. He's rendered really well, like superhero style, right?
Yeah.
Like really good muscles and the energy and the color.
And
really
smiling.
Nice.
He looks so cocky. Like
he does.
It's the perfect Flash pose.
Now, if you Google this cover, but if you go to amputeecomics.com, you can see both covers. We have them in the article. But if you Google this cover, you won't actually see all the Bendy dots going on.
Right.
I think like the early version, it was very flat, the city, the skyscrapers. It's, but he's added a layer to it where it's almost like 3D.
Uh-huh.
There's like a Bendy dot layer repeating the windows of the building and like the glinting of the windows.
Yeah, like
and
he's
vibrating.
And then
also the moon. Yeah. And it's just so cool. Like, it just draws your eye in and you're like, whoa, what is this crazy world we're in?
It almost looks like whenever you'd find like an old 3D comic in back issue bin, but you didn't have the glasses that went with it.
Right.
It's like in
an
a good
optical
way.
Illusion. Yeah, exactly.
It's really cool.
The variant covers for The Flash, because I mean, Mitch Gerard's done a bunch and I've picked a bunch of those over the last couple podcasts. Like, they're just killing it on these variant covers.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, the variant isn't telling us anything about the story, which is kind of defeating the purpose of a cover into some sense. But I mean, this cover gets me jazzed to read The Flash, so why not?
Yeah, absolutely.
In our next segment, we're going to be talking with Josh Williamson. He's been writing The Flash since June 8th, 2016, and much of that run has been double shipped. This guy's working his ass off. And you might also know him from Image Comics like Nailbiter and Birthright. And he will be writing a new series in August involving two characters you might have heard of. It's called Batman Superman. And he'll be teamed up with David Marquez. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's been a long time coming.
Now, Batman Superman, this has to be like a dream come true project. Am I right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I have asked for it many times. And I was just thinking about this a few days ago and I kind of forgot about it. Way back in 2010, it might have been 2009. Basically, when I first started at DC way back in 2009, I would do all these like little small projects.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So 2009, like I would do small stuff, like a short story here or there, you know, whatever. And
sure.
I would do these little tiny things, like a 10 pager, a 5 pager, you know, 8 pager. I would do whatever they were like, do you want to write this thing? And I'm like, sure, I'll do that. And one of the people at DC, he pulled me aside at San Diego Comic-Con. And yeah, this was 2009. So 2009, he pulls me aside and he goes, all right, here's the deal. We're going to have you do this thing called inventory. And so inventory stories, if people don't know, is basically like DC or Marvel pretty much hire you to do something that is in continuity, but is like not within the current story. So you basically just telling like a basic story with this character. They use those in case they need to like slot
one in.
Or they plan things out. Sometimes they're planned out or they're just like, let's give people a break or whatever, right? And so they were like, we're going to have you do an inventory story. And everyone, most people do them. It's like part of your thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And getting into Marvel and DC. And part of it is just to check and see where you are in terms of talent and professionalism. And really want to make sure you're not a crazy person.
It's a barometer.
You know, yeah, I think you can't even do the inventory story. It's a pretty good gauge of like, this person might not be able to handle the series.
Right.
So they pulled me aside to San Diego and they were like, here's a deal. We're going to give you an inventory story. And you have a choice. You can either do a Batman one or you can do a Superman one. But don't say Batman because everyone always does Batman. I was like, all right, let me come back at you. What if I did a Batman and Superman story, them together as a team up? And they were like, no one has ever said that before. Yes, you can do that. And I was
like,
this is my thing. Like, I want to write team ups. Like, I love, that's probably one of my favorite things as a kid to read was whenever superheroes met. And I'm probably going to write those. So, you know, I want to do that. And so I went and I said that. And then they had me do like 3 Batman, Superman inventories. One of them actually came out. It was the Supergirl and Damian issue that was in.
Oh,
Superman.
Great.
And they were just like, yeah, you know, do this. So I did a few of those. And then I knew that they were kind of in a weird spot where they weren't sure who was going to take over the book. And so I asked to take over. What was weird at the time, I had ideas, but I didn't have a story, which was kind of an important lesson that I had to learn. There's a difference between like having ideas that are just kind of random things where like, what if this happened? And then an actual story that has like an emotional arc.
Sure.
And so I went to them and I was like, oh, it was, so this is now this is summer of 2010. And I was like, yo, just give it to me. Just give it to me. You know me. You know I'm not crazy. and they were like, oh, maybe let's talk. Let's think about it. Let's talk. And so I talked to the because it was a shared book for a while with like all the editors because it was bad.
Yeah,
all
I
the editors
that.
Shared it. So I was like, can I have it? Can I have it? Can I have it? And they were like, no. But part of it was because in their minds they were like, because again, this is summer 2010.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. You're in the New 52 next year. Like, this book won't exist.
That makes sense.
They're not going to tell me that because I'm just some crazy kid, you know?
So this is a 10-year fruition, right? It's been building to this.
Yeah. So then back in January of 2018, so last year, I was in the office and someone asked me, I'll say it was Dan. So Dan DiDio just asked me straight out, what do you want? What do you want to do? Because my schedule was open. I could take on another book. I could do more stuff. And I was like, well, let me get back and think about it. And we talked about a couple of different books, a couple of different options. But then I was like, no, I know what I want. I want Batman and Superman. And, you know, and I told Dan, it was really funny because it came up by accident because somebody was like, what if we did I don't want to say what this book is because the book isn't happening, but they asked me about something else.
Mm-hmm.
Asked about something else that I was like, well, we're not going to do that. No one's ever going to approve that. We're not going to do it. And,
ooh, it sounds awesome already.
It was this other thing. And I was like, oh, that sounds kind of cool. But it just seems like if you're doing that, why wouldn't you just do Batman and Superman? Like, it was something kind of close. And I'm like, why wouldn't we just do Batman and Superman?
Yeah. They're and so tied together.
I said that. It was on a phone call. And when I said it, I was like, oh, that's all I want to do. So and that's when I told Dan was like, well, here's the thing. He knew I was crazy about it, because if I'm obsessed with something, I'm not gonna let it go.
Sure.
And that's how I was with Flash. That's how I was with Nailbiter and Birthright. Like, there's certain projects, even like Justice League Suicide Squad, because I got that job because I kept asking about it, mostly because I wanted to tie into it and I wanted to know what it was, because I'd heard about it and I was like, what is that and I, you know, just annoying the crap out of them because it's like, we don't know yet. I guess it's yours now. But so Batman and Superman, I kept asking about it, and Dan was like, well, hold up. You know, Tom is doing the wedding, and Bendis has probably, I think at that point, he turned in a couple issues of Man of Steel when I was pitching this. So he was very much like, you got to let those guys have those characters, you know, especially Bendis, who's just coming in.
Right.
You know, like, let him figure out what that book is, because I think they were still in the process of figuring out what it was. Like, Bendis had a lot of ideas, but it was like, let him play with this character that he's going to have kind of ownership of for a while. And I was like, that's cool, but when can I have it? Like, I just wasn't let it go. And so every time I was around them, I would bring it up. Every single time I was around them, bring it up, until finally they were like, okay, fine, you can have it.
Nice.
But we'd have this big story we've been working on. Like, Scott James and I have been developing this really big mega story that we want to tell in the DCU, that really started before Metal. Like, we started having the conversations before Metal. We started having these conversations back in like 2016 of all these
crazy like things we had. Before the Batman Who Laughs even existed.
Yeah, we started having some of these conversations, and it's so funny now, like, thinking about some of the ideas that, like, made it, some of the ones that didn't, and then we had a meeting sometime toward the end of 2016, and I think that was when the Dark Knights, I mean, Scott already knew, he already knew what he wanted to do. He had this idea about the Dark Knights, he had this idea about Batman and Barbatos and all that stuff. He already had ideas for it way back in, even before 2016, because it was something he was seeding in his book.
Right.
He had been seeding in Batman before and during New 52, so he had all these ideas that would already been formulating. And then I remember, we were at a meeting, and he was like, he started talking about the Batman Who Laughs. Like, him and James started talking about it, and it came up. And it was a bunch of different writers in that room during that one, but that's where the Dark Knights came from, was from a lot of that. But we kept having these conversations over and over again. Even when Metal came out, you know, I think Metal number one hadn't come out yet, and we were like, what are we going to do with the ending? And we all started talking about, you know, breaking the source wall. What does that mean? What happens when the source wall breaks? What happens when this happens? And like, when I was pitching Flash War, it was like, okay, well, the force barrier will break because it's weak because the source barrier is broken. Like, we'll be able to, or the source wall is broken. So we started having all these ideas. And
about the fallout.
The fallout from it. And so, last year, we started having conversations about this big story, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and we needed places for things. And I was like, what if I took this big part of the story, the Batman Who Laughs, and the dark multiverse stuff, and the idea that there's going to be essentially sleeper agents, that the Batman Who Laughs, since Metal, has been turning people, basically possessing them to make them be the dark multiverse versions of themselves.
Right.
It's like horrible, like how he is, right? Like, he is the worst version of Bruce Wayne. How can we find this? We started having that conversation, and I was like, well, I'll take it. Like, I'll take it and do it in the Batman Superman book. And I found ways of doing it that I'm really excited about. So that's where a lot of that stuff came from. So yeah, I've been hunting this book down, for like 10 years. Which is a lot. 10 years, yeah.
I mean, when we saw the solicitation with Shazam going dark.
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, that's so dope. You must be having the most fun of your life right now.
Oh, it's awesome. There's some crazy, crazy stuff that we have planned. And there's this thing, like, sometimes we have these conversations about, like, toys. Not the idea of actual physical toys or building toys, but
sure.
Stuff's fun when it happens. But, like, where are the toys at? Like, when you're reading a comic, you're just like, where are the toys? Where is the fun? Where is that thing that's creative that you push, right? Like, push some of the ideas so they're visual, right? It isn't just, like, you know, where can you find these cool visual things that allow you to have these big emotional moments and these actions, but in these great set pieces? You know, I think that's one of the beautiful things about comics. And, you know, like, when you go see a play, so you go see a stage play, and I love going to the theater, and I like going to musicals, and you go, and you can have a play where it's just two people. You can do a whole play, it's two people. One time when I was young, I saw Patrick Stewart do a one-man performance of The Christmas Carol. And he had
a
tower of props in the middle of the stage, and he would just take off at like Jenga, right? And he would just take from this huge prop of whatever prop he needed, and he played every part, and he did the whole thing. And it was awesome. You can do that, and it's great. But if you could find to do that in comics, where there are moments where those set pieces are not a stage, instead of it being a stage, it is, you know, a giant fight in space and there's monsters everywhere. Like, sure. You can find ways, but you can still get that emotion. You can still get that performance out of those characters, where instead of being on a stage, it's this big crazy thing. Like, in Flash, a lot of times the characters are always talking in the Speed Force. Like, they're always running. It's that same idea. It's the same idea of
sure. You
know, might as well be two people standing on a stage, but instead I'm doing it with them running in the Speed Force. Like, one of my favorite scenes that we did, and it was funny, it was in Flash 6, where it's Barry talking to August when Barry's pretty much figured out that he's Godspeed and he's mad.
Right.
And I took this influence of, like, all this imagery of, like, samurai standing in fields and having a showdown, you know, or even that, like a Wild West showdown. And so that's what I sent all this art to Carmine, who was drawing that scene. And it's a scene of just Barry and August, and they're standing in a field and they're just like talking, but there's a visual component. It could have just been a stage, you know. It's like,
sure,
it's the two of them talking and having this sort of performance, but you can have this awesome set piece.
It's kind of an iconic look to it.
Yeah. And so that's the thing with Batman and Superman. Like, there's moments where it's these two characters, we all know who they are,
right?
Yeah.
But being able to show them a different light, show this tension, this situation they're in. Because one of the things we remember is that, like, the Batman who laughs is Bruce. He's not the Joker. This is something I think people forget. He's not the Joker.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, it's easy to forget absolutely. That.
Yeah, people think he's the Joker, but he's Bruce. And so because he's Bruce, he was friends with Superman on his world, right? Like, they were friends too there. So when he comes over here, and he will say the most mean, horrible things. Like, he's Bruce at his worst, right? Like, every bad impulse that Bruce has, he doesn't have a problem unleashing. Imagine that person sitting there talking to Superman and being like, I know what Batman really thinks of you. You know? Like, and Superman's smart enough, obviously, Superman, to know that Batman who laughs is lying. Or is he, right? Like, it's that idea, like, it's still enough to get under his skin. It's still enough to make him angry. It's still enough to piss him off. And he also knows Batman really well. And he knows that Batman is this kind, good person. But, you know, he recognizes that Batman is the smartest one of them and could be a very dangerous person. Like, he sees that, you know, and I think it's interesting, like, they both see that in each other. Like, Batman can see in Superman that, like, oh, if this person ever did decide to get out of control, it would be a problem. But I know he won't. I have faith and trust in him. But if he did, you know, like, it's that idea. And I think they both have that back and forth.
Sure.
And they're trying to make a decision if they're going to tell people or not. Are they going to lie about this? Are they going to tell other heroes that the Batman who laughs has done this thing?
Right. There's a moral thing going on.
That was something we were wondering, is if, because you said in an interview that they'll be spying on other heroes' friends and allies. Is there, like, a side of them that's going to question the morality of that?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Yeah. They're definitely going to sit there and have a conversation of, like, are we doing the right thing?
Sure.
And
which is huge, especially with Superman, who's always morally correct, right?
Tries
to be, yeah.
About that, about who Superman would tell, you know, like would he? And it's been interesting to have those conversations with people and other writers and people editorial and what I learned this thing a while back with writing, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But the conversations that we have, they have the same conversations, right? Like if when we question the moral situations that they're in, they're questioning it too.
Why wouldn't they also? Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, like they're not character. You know, I mean, they're not fictional characters. Like they're characters. That's the best versions of them.
Right.
So you want to make sure that you can. If we're thinking about it, so are they. So I wanted to put that in there, where there are times where it's like that. Yeah, like I think especially Batman. Well, Superman for sure, but Batman has already gone on this path and learned the lesson. Like Superman's always kind of known, like, and he can't help it sometimes, right? Like with the hearing. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And a spinal
that's true. Right. X-ray vision.
Yeah, hello. Like he learned
there's
it.
No secrets.
Whereas in Batman has made, you know, he wants to know everything about everybody, impulsively, I think, obsessively, and you know he assesses every situation, every person, and you know he's makes sure that I think he has faith in people, but he still wants to make sure of things.
He's very guarded.
Yeah. So for him, but he's already got on this path of like me surveying, having surveillance and spying on people I consider friends is not the
right.
best. But now he's in a situation where he might have to do that again, you know, where he's having to, because they don't want, it's kind of like the end of the thing, right? Where Childs and, well, you know, it's Keith David and Kurt Russell. They're in the snow at the ending, and it's that whole thing of like, you could be one of those things.
Right.
You know, I could be one of those things. How do we not know?
Is it better to go down together or to trust one another?
Yeah, and then think about how that movie is, like in the thing where they're having to go and like test each other out to find out who it is. We've had a lot of conversations about trying to find ways of doing that kind of tension in those kind of scenes where it's like you gotta verify, make sure everybody hasn't been infected, make sure he hasn't turned somebody into a sleeper agent we don't know. But my book is, I almost gave something away. My book is very much like the action book. I will say this book, it's going to impact other books. And so because this book will impact other books, the other books will have the ability, I think, to flesh out some of those storylines. Like there's other books where you get to see a little more about how this story starts to affect everybody else and how it starts to affect people once they start finding out about it, once it becomes obvious. Because you can't have it where it's like, you know, if there are
six, a secret. Yeah.
If there's six people who have been infected, then that's going to be obvious at some point or another.
Right. Six corners of the DC universe.
But on the other side of that tension, like, the Batman and Superman is like maybe the greatest bromance in comics. Or will we kind of see a little bit of a lighter side to that? Or is it going to be kind of all business?
At times, I try to find places for it, but it is a lot of business. That was a conversation we had where it was like, there were times I was putting jokes in, and it was like, does Superman really make a joke right now? Like,
right.
They make a joke when they're realizing that, like, you know, people that they love are in danger. Would he make a joke right now? And I'm like, no. Like,
right. It's hard to find that balance without feeling like you're making light of the story.
Yeah. Man feels responsible for a lot of the
stuff.
Responsible, regardless of, he is not the Batman who laughs. The Batman laughs is in him. Mm-hmm. Bruce can't help but feel responsible for some of these things.
Absolutely.
So that creates some sense of urgency for him and some nervousness where he doesn't really want to like be friendly. Like there's a scene where Superman and Gordon are being really friendly to each other, and Batman is just like, "We do not have time for you two to be friendly."
Oh, I like, love that.
You know, like, you stuff I need to, do. Need to get this stuff going. Like, I need your help with this.
Sure.
So it's like an action thriller, basically, right?
Yeah. That's how I was trying to shape it. You know, there's elements of horror, some horror storytelling that I learned from doing Nailbiter and Ghosted and stuff. But this is a book I wanted to do forever. And then I got lucky that David Marquez was able to do it. We weren't sure if he was going to be able to, if he was going to stay with Marvel or not. We also didn't want to be like shady about it. We wanted to make sure that he was good and Marvel was good and everybody was in the free and clear before
we
started working and everything.
Right.
But yeah, the moment he was like, I'm done, I'm like, here's the script, please go. Please get started, please. And then pages start coming in and they're always awesome. The cover to issue 3 is cool.
It's so cool.
Yeah, he's awesome.
His work on the Defenders like blew me away every page.
So oh, yeah.
You know, he's all digital.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I was actually looking to buy some original art from him, and I saw it was like a reprint because he doesn't actually put pen to paper.
He does a few things. So like the covers are always traditional. And I think sometimes like it was a certain two-page spread. So like the first time Batman and Superman are together in a two-page spread in the book, he drew that one. And I think it sold already. Like it was already.
Ugh, he's so good.
So like the covers usually, but yeah. I always get the last page of books I work on, which the last page of issue ones of a book I work on, I always try to get. I don't always, but I have like for Nailbiter, Ghosted, and Birthright, I have the last pages of issue one, and like Illuminati and a few others, I have the last page.
Nice.
But so yeah, he one day showed me the inked version. Like he was like halfway through inking the last page of issue one, and I was like, "Oh, you're actually doing that?" And he was like, "Yeah, I thought I would." And I was like, "Mine."
If you put those all together, you could do like a choose your own adventure, maybe.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah.
Have you approached writing this series any differently than you have with Flash?
Yeah, of course. Because like the Flash, it's different. Well, team books are really hard. That was the lesson I learned with Odyssey. Team books are really hard. James is terrific at them, you know, working with Justice League and Justice League Dark, and when he was doing Detective, which might as well have been a team book. I mean, it was a team book. He's great at it. I am not so great at it. I have a hard time managing that many voices. Where with Flash, like, even with Nailbiter, it was like everything kind of centered around the voices of those three characters of like the Nailbiter, Warren, and then Crane and Finch. Once I can hear their voices, I can run with it. And with Flash, it's always been like one him and another character. So it's like whenever I'm writing an issue, it's like I know his POV and Iris's POV, or Flash's and Godspeed's, or Flash's and Wally's, or Flash's and Wallace, right? Like every issue always kind of had, you know, there's different voices and different story elements going around, but every issue always have like, if I have this character and this character, you know, or every scene, if I know Barry versus this person and they can play off each other. With this book, it was fun, really. I mean, it's still dark and tense, but it really comes down to being able to hear Bruce and Clark's voices and how they work with each other. With Flash, everything always has to come around to an idea of hope. Even when he's being pessimistic, it's like the pessimism is obvious because he is a hopeful character, right? Whenever he's having kind of a darker moment, which we were doing a lot of dark stuff with him before year one on purpose, so you could see him kind of come back around to being optimistic during year one. Like he'll remember it, and that was a major part of that thread. With this book, Superman is definitely, you know, truth, justice, the American way, you know, big, you know, larger than life superhero who feels the world and is genuinely a nice person. He is genuinely a moral, nice person, but he can still be serious. You know, he has those moments of anger. You see it a lot in Bendis's run. It's like when Bendis had it where when John, the new teenage John, is like telling him about what happened, he's like, excuse me for a minute, and he goes and like beats up Mongol and then comes back and,
yeah, right,
it's always Mongol too, like it's you know, what do you get the man who has everything, right? It's
yeah,
like,
yeah,
you know, he comes
who
out
can
of,
I hit the hardest,
yeah, he comes out of the vision and he's like burn to Mongol. You know, he has those moments, but he's also, you know, he's an investigative reporter, he's a detective too. And so, yeah, it's interesting to kind of write this book and approach it of, like, there's also a pacing difference. Like, a Flash book, I think, should be read faster, right? There's a certain pacing to it that I think you need to kind of move along quicker, which is how I always write the Flash book. I always write a little faster, a little... It's supposed to have that feeling of quickness across it.
Are you still writing your dialogue via, like, just talking into a recorder?
Sometimes. I did that this week.
You mentioned that in an interview we did once.
Yeah, I'll go for a walk or I'll drive and I'll record myself talking to myself in character, almost like method acting.
Oh my god, so you're doing like a gravelly Batman voice?
Depends on who it is. Okay. I haven't had to do it as much as Batman because I'm a big... it's funny, like in Batman Superman, Batman has a few lines, but Superman has way more lines than Batman does. Batman Returns, Michael Keaton talked about how he felt that, and he would not rewrite the script, but he basically would say to Tim Burton, like, no, he's not going to say that because he would say something much shorter. Mm. And I always kind of like that version of Batman.
Nice.
That's less wordy.
I, Yeah, that's where you get like really great moments where he just straight up says, "You're not the mayor." Like Keaton originally had like all these monologues that he would just kind of cut out because he's like he's more of like a get stuff done.
Yeah, that makes sense. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's how I write him, where I feel like there's definitely moments where he comes in and he'll say like, "These are the priorities" or whatever, right? Like that isn't a line of dialogue, but it's like. Yeah. You know, he does sort of, this is what the problem is. But I try to keep his dialogue very curt, short, to the point.
Love
you know,
that.
Bruce, when he's Bruce, I think it's different. Like, you know, once he has
the persona,
I think he will. Like, there's a scene in issue two where they're at the Fortress of Solitude and he has his mask off and he's talking to Mark. And that is probably the most dialogue he has in the entire book, is in that scene. But he's being Bruce in that moment, you know, it's his mask.
Sure.
Talking to Clark, and it's the two of them talking about something that they're upset about. He's frustrated with something,
but he's let his guard down.
Right,
but he doesn't have the cowl on protecting him.
Well, that was the thing with when we did The Price. There's a scene at the end of The Price where mm-hmm. Barry and Bruce are talking, and they're arguing, and they both had their masks off during that scene, and that was on purpose. The idea of having their masks off, that moment they were friends, and they were having a conversation, and they're going back and forth. The moment Bruce puts his mask back on there, that was a sign of, like, he is putting his guard back up in front
of him.
Yeah, and then they, you know, that was this whole scene where Barry almost punched him in the face and was like, "I could have, and I'm not going to."
Mm-hmm.
That was on purpose. Like, I had them do that scene with no masks on because they were friends, and they were having a conversation. The moment the conversation turned and it became obvious there's tension here, they both put their masks back on because they both were putting their guards back up. It was supposed to be symbolic of, like,
it's a good idea.
You know, yeah. So I always think there's a difference. Like, when Bruce has his mask off, he's still Batman, but it's different. It's different. Mm-hmm. He's opening up to you when he takes the mask off.
He's not putting on the show.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, the performance, because he's obviously, and I've had this conversation with a lot of people lately about how he is, a lot of his performance art, you know, like a lot of him putting on a show, you know, like a lot of Batman is showmanship, right?
Yeah, right.
Whereas Superman is not. Like, Superman is not that. To me, there is nothing showy about Superman. Everything he does is either by accident, which sounds silly, right? Like, I don't think when he comes down and the sun hits him just right and he's coming down and his cape's blowing in the wind and he just looks majestic. He looks like this alien savior that has come to save the day.
Right.
I don't think there is anything planned about that. I think that is just who he is.
Josh, come on, though. He is wearing red tights. I mean, he's drawing attention somewhere. Let's be honest.
Those are the colors of his people. He was wearing that cape when he was a baby.
Yep.
That's why we got the trunks back, y'all.
But, hey, might we see Flash in Batman Superman, or is that a spoiler?
No, he's in it. There's a scene in the issue just looking at. He's in it. I mean, everyone's in it. Like, a lot of people are in it. Like, that was one of the appeals for David when I went and pitched him the whole book. I was like, listen, this is a book about Batman and Superman, but you get to draw everybody. And he was like, oh,
yeah. Talk about the best book to jump in on. When I saw, you know, that it was announced you guys were working together, I was like, wow, David is coming in hot.
Yeah. The pages are amazing. The stuff he's doing is just crazy. And we got Alejandro Sanchez, who is the colorist on Jorge on Justice League.
Yeah.
And he's also doing like a different style. Like, he's doing something that's a little more painted for this, right? Like, Justice League's big, bold, bombastic colors. And the stuff that Scott's been doing over there is the same thing. It's big, it's bold, right? It's bombastic. And so the art has been really reflective of that with Jorge. With the story that we're doing, our story is a little more quiet and subdued at first. Part of the reason why our story is a little more quiet, it's interesting. Like, I feel like the way I approach this book, to get back to your initial question, is that, like, I'm approaching it, it is a thriller, and it is going to feel quiet at times. It's going to feel smaller at times. Mm-hmm. But it's because they're trying to keep this thing between the two of them. They're trying to keep it quiet. They're trying to keep what's happening down.
Right.
This would be, like, a case. By the end, you'll see it just gets bigger and bigger and escalates until they can no longer, just the two of them, contain it. And then it'll be part of a bigger story it's a major part. And I know Scott has talked about this a little bit, that, like I said earlier, we have this big major story we're telling. And this is a huge piece of that. And then once you get to the end of this arc, you're going to see how much it starts to balloon out and become a much bigger problem in the DCU.
And the arc ends in December, is that right? Or is it January?
It's weird. So my answer to that is yes.
Gotcha. 10-4.
Five is the end of this arc, and then six is going to tie into the end of the arc. So it's almost like six is the coda of five. So when it's collected, it'll be six issues in the trade, but you'll be like, oh, five is a climax, and then six is like the epilogue of that arc. Gotcha. And then seven will be a whole new story that we're doing, and you know, I can't talk about the X is too early.
It's taken you 10 years to get this book. When will you relinquish it? Like never or
of Batman Superman?
Yeah.
I know how I want to end it when I'm done with it. So it's just a matter. It's like everything. It matters with sales, how I'm doing, and if I feel burnt out on it or not, you know, but so far I haven't felt burnt out at all. And I'm really having a lot of fun with it. And again, it's like, where can I find the toys to build and do great stuff? Right. Like, where can I, what scenes can I see with these characters? You know, like one of the things I want to do is have Superman drive the Batmobile at some point, and I haven't yet. So it's I have no time. So there's things like that where I'm like, see, until I get to do everything I want, that's when I'll leave. Flash, you know, at this point, I've written 84 Flash issues. I've written 84 Flash comics. I know the last scene. Like, when I decide to leave the book, like, I know that last arc. I know that last scene, like, the back of my hand. Like, I can see it in my hands how it's going to play out and what I want to say with the character by the ending. With that, I just want to make sure I get there and feel like I have no regrets. You know, I don't want to go back. I think that it's always kind of weird when a creator goes back to a character later. That everyone has done it.
Well, maybe with like a 30-year gap.
Yeah, everyone's done it, because even Jeff and Mark both went back to Flash, and
everyone wants Scott to go back to Swamp Thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we talked about it briefly when he was on the show a couple weeks ago.
He has story ideas.
Yeah, he said Greg wants to do it, but it's just about timing.
It's all about timing, yeah. I mean,
speaking of timing,
but yeah, go ahead.
How long has the Flash Year One story been percolating in your mind? You must have been wanting to tell this for a while.
I pitched it for the first time right after issue one came out.
Oh wow! So,
oh dang! Okay.
Right after issue one came out, and I was like, I don't even know what I was pitching it for. Or why? It's just, you know, every year you want to pitch your stories. I mean, that's really what it comes down to when you're on these characters. And I've had this conversation with other creators where it's like, you can't just go in and say, I want this character just because, or it's me, that's why you should give it to me, like, you know?
Right.
And at the end of the day, and honestly, that's not truthful to the character or to you as a creator. Like, if you have a story to tell and a take and a thing you want to say about the character, like, you know, that's what you need to do. And issue one, I think I had written the first eight issues. I'd written the first eight. I was writing nine, and I was just looking at all the stuff I wanted to do. Because at that point, I was like, well, how long am I going to be on this book for? You know? Yeah. Originally, I thought, I want to do 12 issues. I'm only going to be able to be on it for 12 issues. But I had all these ideas. I had like a million ideas that could go past 12. But when I first pitched for it, the story I pitched was 12 issues long. But that was because I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know anything about Rebirth when I pitched it. I just pitched this story, and you know, had a bunch of ideas for it because I love the character. So one of those ideas was to do a year one. And so I had this meeting with them right after one came out. I think issue two had come out. Mm-hmm. And I sat down and I was like, I want to do a year one, but this is what I want to do. I pitched him the first issue. I was like, it's everything you know. He becomes the Flash, hit by lightning. And then he's running. And he finally feels happy for the first time since his mom died. And all of a sudden he gets a burst of energy because he's happy, right?
Yeah.
He's having a joyful moment. He gets a burst of energy. And then, you know, white energy explosions. He slams on the brakes. He looks up, and it's the future, and the future is horrible. And suddenly there's Old Man Flash there, and he's like, what did you do this time? And, and which is issue one. Like, I basically, that was my pitch 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And so, or 2 years ago? 3 years ago. So
almost 3 years ago, yeah.
So wow. I was like, this is what I want to do. And I said, I was like, listen, it's not year one. It's year one and Dark Knight put together. Like, that was how I pitched it.
Yeah.
And they were like, we love that. We'll do that. When do you want to do it? And I'm like, when do you guys want to do it? And that conversation went on for 2 years. So
but if we've learned anything from this interview, you are a planner, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as I can.
Yeah.
Also, I said before we were talking, I have to be careful because there's stuff that I'm thinking about that isn't going to happen until like 2021. So I'm like, talk about that. So it's like I went in and I was really like, I like, this is what I want to do. And then we had all these conversations, and they were really good. They were like, that sounds cool, but what's it about? What do you say about Barry? What's important about Barry? And I was like, well, to me, I think, you know, Jeff said it best, where he's like, after Barry's mom died, he was standing still, right? And it wasn't until he became the Flash that he started to move forward again. But to me, it's not the powers. It's not the powers that made him do that, right? It's like he relearned his optimism. And so the conversation we were having was that, like, he didn't get optimism from the Lightning. He always had optimism. The Lightning might have reignited that in him. But let's tell that story. Let's tell the story about how Barry went from being somebody who was optimistic and then was no longer optimistic and was literally afraid of the future, which is part of what being pessimistic can be, is you're constantly predicting bad things in the future. He's then confronted with the idea that he is right, that the future is crappy. Right? He is personally. And then he still, even though he sees the future as crappy, he knows the future being crappy, he can push through and find his optimism and be like, we can make the best of this and relearn that optimism. And that was what I wanted to do. And we've had those conversations over the last 3 years. And then around the same time I was pitching the Batman Superman stuff, we were having all these conversations about what we were going to do with the book post Flash War. And there was a conversation about doing year one immediately after Flash War, but wanted Howard. There was a timing problem. There's just a timing and scheduling problem. And I was like, there's no way Howard can do Flash War and then year one. It just isn't possible.
Right.
And I wasn't ready yet either. I wanted to make that my time. So we were able to make it work. And that's why, so Howard will do this and then he'll finish year one. He'll do like a couple issues. He'll do an issue of Justice League and then he'll do a couple like one-off issues of Flash. And then he'll start drawing the big story we have planned next year for Flash. So it'll be like each year, like a big Howard Porter drawn Flash.
Nice.
That's exciting.
You know, so last year was Flash War. This year it's year one. And the next year we'll get something that's really big.
You're going to do the Button sequel, right?
I mean, but it's funny. The Button comes up all the time. It's so crazy.
Everyone loves it.
Everyone loves it. Tom and I were sitting next to each other at a signing in Florida a few weeks ago, and he was like, it's the number one thing we sign. We sign that more than we sign anything else.
Wow.
And so I made a joke to him. I was like, we should do a sequel. And he was like, no. So, yeah.
Well, we know you you collect the final pages, or try to collect the final pages of your books. Is there anything else you collect, comics or non-comics related?
I wish you guys could see my office right now.
Oh, man. That is the picture.
I collect a lot of comic books.
Fantastic.
I'm a big old... I've basically started reading comics as a little kid, and I collect a lot of stuff. So mostly comics. So I really get... So what happened was about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I moved from San Diego to Oregon. At the time, I had 100 long boxes. And so I sold all of that. And I also sold... I had a bunch of statues and toys. I had, like, all the Marvel Legends. I had all the Marvel Bowen minibus. I had a bunch of stuff. I sold everything. Not all. I shouldn't say all. I had a good collection. I had, like, 6 or 7. But I had the ones that I liked. Yeah. And I sold everything off and moved. And I've slowly gotten some things back. So it's, like, I have a pretty good collection of hardcovers and trades. But, like, for DC stuff, like, I have all the DC Absolutes, except for the Sandman ones and the Promethea ones.
Okay.
Sandman, because I have those in the original hardcovers they put out, like, almost 20 years ago now, I guess. I have those, and, like, that's my Sandman book. You know, I don't need the... Even though I know they recolored it, which always makes me kind of want to get them.
Yeah. Right. They're so big, though. They're hard to read.
Well, see, I wish that Absolute Editions came with, like, a digital copy. So you could, like, automatically, I could be like, all right, cool, I'm going to read this on my iPad. But then, the beautifulness of this in the Absolute. But so I have all the Absolutes. Anything Batman-related, I have a lot of Batman stuff. So, like, Mondo released a really cool Batman animated series toy. I have that. Plus, I have, like, the records they did.
Those are great. The Harley Quinn one especially is one of my faves.
Yeah, so I have all those. I have a lot of hardcovers. Like, pretty much if DC puts out an omnibus, I get it. Thankfully, now I get a lot of stuff from them. Nice. But even before that, I had a lot. And so I still go to the comic shop every week, and I pick up mostly trades. It depends on the book. It just depends on the book. Like with Image, I always buy the trades and stuff. I'll give anything a try because those are the volume ones are like $10. So I'll go in and
oh yeah,
those, you know. Legos. I have all of the...
Is it all in one room, Josh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
We're actually building an office. So my office right now is pretty big.
Out of Lego.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Man, I wish. I'm not sure it would be more expensive. But no, we're slowly building a studio office above our garage. It'll be like the size of a two-car garage. And in there will be all this stuff and then my tiny desk in the middle of it all. Like, I have a life-size, giant bust of the Michael Keaton Batman Returns cowl. I have a power battery. What was I got in here? I got a ton of stuff, man. But yeah, with Legos, I usually stick to certain things here and there. So it's like, I'll usually get anything that's like a Batman related Lego or DC related Lego. So like when they made that Lego movie, I made the mistake of being like, I'm going to get all of these. And they just kept them.
Yeah, there's so many sets. Yeah.
So I have some prints, but mostly comic stuff. Like I have a lot of nerdy comic book stuff in here that I just kind of lose my mind. They're in my closet. I have most of those Mattel DC toys they made.
Oh, great.
The DC Universe ones, I have most of those. It just depends. Like, I have a couple friends that work in the merchandising department, so sometimes I get stuff from them, but I have a lot of stuff in here, yeah.
You've earned the perk, let me tell you.
Yeah. I have a Flash toy, which I had before I got the job. I have almost every Flash toy that's been made. I'm missing, like, maybe three. It's just a matter of I haven't gotten them. And some of them I have in boxes, I haven't opened them yet. And I have a lot of Batman Black and Whites. I only have one spinner rack in my office, but I have another spinner rack in the garage that will go in the new office once we get it built. So, yeah, I have a lot of junk.
But it's priceless. It's priceless.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's all here in my office. Like, people, I had, a few months ago, around Thanksgiving. Oh, it was the day after Thanksgiving. The day after Thanksgiving, Sam Humphries and I had lunch, and he came over here, and he was like, Jesus Christ. And we were hanging out, and I was like, oh, I'll take you home. Or he was staying at Bendis' house he was having Thanksgiving with him. Mm-hmm. And Bendis was like, well, I've never been to Josh's house before. I'll come pick you up. And so I thought it was just going to be Bendis, but it was Bendis and David Mack. So all of a sudden, my office, which is like Nerdapalooza, was like hungry and Bendis. And Bendis was just like, Jesus Christ, you are a nerd. Because I have like an Infinity Gauntlet on the ground and I have Tony's helmet. And,
oh, yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
Oh, God, can we come over and play?
Yeah, right.
It's pretty nutty here. It's a pretty crazy off. But yeah, anytime it's important, let me know. You guys can come check this. It's a mess right now, though. It is an absolute mess because I also use a lot of stuff for research and just kind of like, you know, getting a feel for certain things. And then I get, and I just don't have enough room in here anymore. So, yeah. And also we get comps. So it's like we get comps of books and then we get our books. And so every 2 weeks I've gotten like a stack of Flash books.
Yeah, it's piles of them.
Piles and piles of them. And I usually just give them to the library, but that means I have to actually pack them up and go to the library.
There was a period where DC was sending me like 28 single issues a week. They stopped doing that. It's just digital now, but it's
digital. Yeah.
It was getting a little crazy.
It gets crazy. Yeah. It gets crazy. But
so
yeah.
One more question. As you probably know, AIPT, we were like super supportive of Nailbiter. We were reviewing every issue. I think we even did an exit interview with you.
Yeah, I did. That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm curious. Can we see you and Mike Henderson working together again soon?
Yes.
Ooh. He said it like fantastic. It's like a secret.
Yeah. Yes. Mike and I are really good friends. He lives here in Portland. He used to live closer. He just moved. Him and his wife, they moved into the city. I live in the suburbs. But I talk to him every week. I was just talking to him yesterday. He's funny because anytime I have a creator on an idea, I tell him and he's like, I'll draw that. you know, but yeah, we have two creator-owned books that we want to do that are going to take some time. But there's one we're going to get started on soon. Yeah, we have a couple different things. There's one that we want to do that's kind of obvious and it's something we'll have a lot of fun doing. And there's like the more serious project that we want to do that we're going to take forever on just because we want to really take our time with it. It'll be kind of a more, it'll be a sci-fi thing, but also like a love letter to comics. And so it's going to be, we're going to really be, take our time with it. So it's going to be a little bit before we get to do both of those. But yeah, him and I talk, we were just talking yesterday. I don't remember we were talking about, I think we were talking about junk. Like, you know, he's just a friend. So it's like, we're very close and stuff. So
that's great.
Yeah. I miss working on Nailbiter. Really I miss characters and working with him.
Oh man, now I'm even more excited for right. the future of Josh Williamson and Mike Henderson comics coming to you soon, maybe. Soonish. So, Josh, this is the end of our interview portion.
Yeah.
Can we jump into another segment really quick?
Yeah.
Okay, so in this segment, it's called Square Up, where we take the Skybound game Super Fight, we pull a card, and it's usually an outrageous fight. And now I'm going to randomly generate a DC character and then randomly generate a Marvel character.
Okay.
And then all of us together for about 3 minutes or whatever, not that long, we'll talk about whether or not this these characters, who would win in this fight.
Okay.
So for DC, I'm generating it with this online generator thing. I've got Joker.
Oh,
okay. Okay. And then for Marvel, I've got Thanos.
Okay.
All right. And then we're going to go with...
And it's not a fist fight.
Okay. Who is the best kindergarten teacher? Of Thanos and Joker.
All right.
Oh, man, I was going to be jokey and just answer the Joker no matter what. But that's tough. I feel like, I feel like betraying myself. The better kindergarten teacher, I think the answer is Thanos.
I mean, he's probably going to torture those kids, right? I mean, he's got
to. So would the Joker. Would the kids understand? Yeah. Joker, there's something inherently evil about him that I think
that's true.
Would kids meet the Joker and be like, oh, he's a clown? No. And even if you're not a kid who's afraid of clowns, if you were just a kid, I think you.
Right.
You inherently feel that horrendous negative energy from him.
Yeah, there's like a dread.
There's a dread, a pure chaos, an uncomfortableness.
Yeah.
Whereas Thanos, I think Thanos speaks so calmly and slowly that he would probably... That's the thing you said, torture, right? Like, think about how he was in the movie in particular.
Right.
You know, he was never... And people will tell me I'm wrong on this, but... He maintains a certain calm almost the entire movie, you know? He maintains a certain sureness and confidence. Like, he is the opposite of chaos, right? Like, Joker is a chaotic being, and he gives off the energy of a chaotic being, where Thanos is literally all about order and is an ordered individual. That even when, you know...
He's torturing Nebula?
Torturing Nebula, he speaks to her as in... This is for your own good. I love you. Like, he is the kind of person.
Good intentions.
He thinks he's a good guy. Like, I think the Joker doesn't think he's... Joker's interesting. He is not good. He is not evil. Mm-hmm. He is chaos. Whereas in Thanos, genuinely thinks he is a good person who is doing what is right for everyone. They just don't understand. And that
Piggybacking off of that with Thanos, like you said, he's always super calm to the point where when he's dying in the movie, he kind of just takes a deep breath and has a seat. doesn't freak out over it.
Oh, so he'd be way more patient with the children.
Yeah, but he'd also be very calmly telling them uncomfortable truths, you know, like he, which I don't know that kids exactly respond to well. Like the Joker's at least, very colorful and exciting, even if he's terrifying. But then Thanos is just walk in and like, hello, kids, all is entropy, nothing matters.
One of my favorite scenes of Thanos ever, and I was talking about this with somebody else, I'm not gonna say like, who they were. I was having there was a bunch of creators around, we're all at a table at San Diego Comic Con having drinks before the show's even starting. It started off, it was just me and Tom King. We were just having drinks, and then gradually a bunch of other creators showed up. And one of the creators that was at the table was Andy Kubert. And I love Andy. He's like, I think one of the best artists ever. And we started talking about him drawing Kazar. And one of my favorite scenes in that Kazar run is Thanos versus Kazar. And Thanos is like chasing Kazar down a hallway and it's just, and he's like a giant version of Thanos for some reason. And it's just like some of the dopest art. Andy was like, I remember all of that. It was fun. It was fun. And then somebody else at the table was like, I hated that story. They were like, they started giving me a hard time about it, but I was like, no, come on. There is one page in there where Kazar is running down this hallway in this like cosmic place. And Thanos like, is running so fast, but he's so big he has to like slide around the corner, kind of, you know what I mean?
Squeeze
hitting the brick wall, and it just looks awesome. It just looks awesome. and he does such a great job with it. But yeah, that's the only time I've ever seen Thanos freak out is chasing Kazar down the hallway.
I mean, there's different levels of Joker too, right? Like if you get the Jared Leto Joker, that's a little different than like the Batman the Animated Series Joker.
Who does magic shows for kids.
Oh, he does. That's right.
But when he does that, he's like Bonko or Bozo or whatever. I can't remember the name of it.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
He's planning on killing the mayor's son.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole one, right? Like he is playing a part. So
Jekko. That's what it was.
Jekko. Thank you. Oh, my God. Yes.
I just watched that one recently.
Yeah. So he's playing a part. I think if he's a straight Joker, then yeah, there's no way. Jared Leto,
Josh, your pick is Thanos.
I'm gonna say Thanos. Yeah, I'll say Thanos.
And Nathan,
I'm gonna have to go with the Joker because if there's an end game to it, I think he could do a decent job.
if he knew what he wanted, okay.
Yeah,
I think I'm gonna go with Thanos. Actually, I'm gonna side with you, Josh, because just he seems like he's level headed. He's only gonna do a little light torture, I think.
Yeah.
And by the end they'll all be like very militant and they'll be doing whatever he wants, you see. This is how it works.
And then listen, the Joker, you know he's gonna kill all those kids. With Thanos, he's only gonna kill half. So
that's true.
Some of those kids will get on the school bus at the end of the day if Thanos is teaching. Yeah.
That's
all of them are dead if it's the Joker.
So in our last segment, which we end every show with, the off-topic top shelf, the thing that we're really into that's not comic related. And Josh, we're gonna let you have the floor. What is something you're really into right now that's not comic related?
God, it's so funny. I feel like there's a lot of stuff I'm into that's not comic related right now. Like we were talking before it started about going to Disneyland and going to Star Wars. I'll tell you three things that I'm really into right now. So Star Wars Galaxy's Edge was awesome. Getting to go on that and got to fly the Millennium Falcon, which was like one of the coolest things I've ever done at Disneyland. Like it was funny. The first pilot, I was a gunner on the first one. Like my buddy and I were the gunner and one of my friends was a engineer. The first people flying, they were horrible and they kept crashing. It made the ride like uncomfortable.
Oh.
I was like, is that just how the ride is? Like it's just uncomfortable and it's like really chaotic and
right.
What is the problem? Like they just kept crashing and it was just rough. And then the ending, they tell you how badly the ship is damaged. And it was just like you're dead, essentially. Right. And I was like, God, that sucks. So we went off but we were able to go on two more times after that. And the second time we went on, I was the pilot. And we went on, and it was me and two friends. So six people can sit. So it was me and my two friends, so we're three, and then a group of three. Right before we went on, they were like, because they assign you your jobs before you get on the ride. And you can negotiate with people if you want to trade or whatever. If you don't want to be a pilot, you want to be a gunner or engineer, you can negotiate if you want to trade with each other.
Yeah.
And the other people were like, do you want to be the pilot? And I was like, hell yeah, I want to be the pilot. Get away from me. Like, I'm not giving you a pilot license. And they were like, well, he was the pilot. One of their friends was the pilot. And he was like, yeah, but I sucked. I kept crashing. Like, you know what, though? I've seen it. I think I can do it. Like, I think there's a way of doing it. I think it's obvious. It's like driving. I think people are treating it like, when you're driving, you're not just like yanking the wheel all over the place. You need to. You just kind of keep it in a straight line.
Nice bus driving.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got on, we get in there, and the second time I went on was a blast. Like everyone's yelling at each other, like telling each other what to do, like fire, go right, go left. Yeah, you know, do this. And at the ending they were like, no damage.
Look at that.
And the guys, the people, all of us were like cheering, having like a great time with it.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, so it was one of those moments where it was like me and my friend, your co-pilots, right? Like my buddy and I were the pilots together. And we did a really good job. Like we made it through and we got like a different ending because of it. And the people behind us, they were like, that was way better than we were. we didn't feel sick getting off.
Oh.
And then again, it was funny. The third time we went on, there was a... It was like a little kid, his mom and his grandma. And this grandma has no idea what is happening. She has no, she's got through this line. She doesn't know what ride we're going on. She doesn't know anything. It was great. So guy assigns me, I was a gunner. So he gave me a gunner, gave the mom gunner, gave my buddies engineers, and then gave the grandma and the little kid the pilot. And I was like, oh my God, we're going to crash. And so we're getting up there and I say to the mom is like, how is this? You've been on before? I'm like, yeah, it's my third time on. And the mom and the grandma are like, how is it? And I was like, well, you actually are controlling. And I said to the, they were like, well, he's been on it before, the little boy. And I was like, are you ready to fly it? And he's like, yeah, I think I can do it. He was really little, though. I'm talking like five.
Yeah.
He, yeah, I think I can. I think I can. And I was like, okay, great. Like, that's awesome. And then the grandma was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh, you're actually flying this thing. And she's like, oh, hell no. And she gave me the pilot license.
Oh, nice.
She was the gunner. And I was like, listen, all you got to do when you're the gunner is if you see that light turn on, push it. Like, all you got to do is fire when it tells you to fire. That's all you got to do. You have to aim, you want to target, just fire. Just keep
pushing. What does the engineer do?
Same thing. It's basically like, not to get too into spoilers, but it's like part of the ride. The engineer is very important. Okay. So they're handling certain stuff, but the main thing that they control that's important is the grappling gun. There's like a, yeah, it's like a harpoon that has rope on it. I can't remember what it's called. What?
Oh, no, I said that's dope.
Yeah, the engineer's, like, main thing, but they're also controlling other stuff. Like, everyone has things cool. They have to do. And, you know, when you're the pilot on the left, you control going left and right. You control the brakes. You also control the boosters. The person on the right, they control up and down, but then they also control the hyperspace stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's awesome. Like, I can't even get into how freaking much fun this was. But so we got on there, and the kid was good. Like, it was one of those things where I'm like, oh, you play video games. You understand this. Like, go left and right. Don't crash into anything. You got this. Uh-huh. It was funny. There's a part toward the ending where you have to hit the boosters to, like, survive.
Oh, no.
And this kid couldn't reach it. Like, he had his hand out. Oh, and was,
no.
Like, his finger was touching it, but he couldn't get to it until it down. But that was fun. That was, like, days later, I was talking to a friend of mine. And we got home, and I was talking to a buddy, and I was like, oh, I just had so much fun flying the Millennium Falcon. And I was telling him this whole thing, and he was like, yo, dude, you told me this like 3 days ago. but yeah,
that's how jazzed you are.
Yeah. my wife and I right now, we're rewatching West Wing, which is weird because I watched it before, but I guess I haven't watched it in a long time, probably 10 years. Mm. And so it's interesting to watch something. It's like when you're rereading a book or anything and you kind of forgotten just enough where it feels new, but then suddenly certain things will come back to you as you're watching.
Sure.
She's never watched it before, so it's interesting watching that. And then this is my random thing that I was into this morning because I just had a lot of fun watching it last night. Are you aware there is a show on television?
Uh-huh.
Holy Moly. And it is about competitive extreme miniature golf.
What? No, yes! Way.
It's dude, hosted. It's hosted by Stephen Curry.
I saw an ad for that the other day, and I missed what the name was. Sorry, I'm like screaming right now because I was trying to figure out what this show was.
It's called.
What channel is it on?
I don't know. Oh. I don't know.
That sounds amazing.
So I had heard something about it the other day, and there was this show on Spike TV back in the late 90s or 2000s called MXC.
Yes, I love that show.
Okay, all right. So I saw a little bit of this Holy Moly thing, and it reminded me of MXC because it has these two guys who are announcers, and I can't remember who their announcer is. Like, he's a famous comedian, like somebody you would recognize. Like, he's been in Step Brothers, and
wow,
he has like a very loud, he's an actor who has like a very loud, boisterous voice. Like, he's a big guy, and he always has like snarky things, and he's one of the announcers. And then there's like a straight man who like knows miniature golf and golfing.
Is it Rob Riggle?
Yes.
I just looked this up. This is amazing. Yes.
Okay, so last night we were running late. You know, we have a kid, and I got off. I finished writing late, and so we were just like trying to figure some stuff out. And I ended up ordering pizza for dinner, and it was like some time. Let's just put junk on. What's on? Mm. And so I went to Hulu, and I was actually I have this idea for a TV show I want to work on. So I'm going to try to write like a pilot for it sometime in the future. Like, I have kind of the story down. I have certain ideas for it, but I was thinking about the structure of Lost. It is nothing like Lost, but I was thinking about the structure of Lost, and I was like, oh, I kind of want to know. I think Lost is on Hulu. I'm just going to see what's on there. And then sometime the next year I'll watch it. Cause I'm just curious about the structure of that first episode. Cause I think the first episode is good. Right.
Oh yeah.
It's a classic.
Yeah, with like S.H.I.E.L.D. and Breaking Bad, like these episodes, you know, that are very good first episodes. Same thing like we were talking about West Wing. Like, West Wing has a great first episode. So I was trying to figure out, I was thinking about it. So I went on there and I'm like, oh, Lost is on Hulu. Okay, cool. And then there's Holy Moly. I was like, let's just do an hour length of pizza to get here, right? What's pizza get here? It's a little bit like MXC, mixed with miniature golf. Because
so there's like an obstacle course?
Yeah, they have to go through the obstacle course.
I gotta watch this show.
Is it like Wipeout in a sense?
Yes, it's like Wipeout, but they're doing miniature
golf at the
same time.
Wow. See, I grew up on Cape Cod where there is a miniature golf course every 15 feet.
Sure. Yeah.
So now I'm like so excited to check this out. It's on
Panama City Beach is the same way.
I was cracking up. I legit, like, you know, this week was, it wasn't hard, but there's weeks where, you know, there are weeks of this job that can be difficult. Like, it's awesome to be like superheroes and come up with comic ideas, but there are days where, you know, sometimes it's harder than others and sometimes they're great and sometimes just you're not feeling it, you know? And this week I was just struggling with stuff. I was just struggling with getting some stuff across the finish line.
Uh-huh.
And so
the holy moly got you through it.
Holy moly got me through it. Like, I was watching it last night and I was like, this is...
I am going to decompress with this tonight, you guys.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's really weird. It's funny, but I was cracking up. I was legit cracking up watching it.
All right. So this is the end of our show. Thank you so much for being on. This has been a blast to chat with you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was fun with you guys.
If you've made it this far, please like, subscribe, and even review the show. And thank you so much for listening.